Crawford stood alone in the center of his study, with his hands jammed deep in his pockets. He stood there from 12:30 a.m. to 12:33, demanding an idea. Then he telexed the California Department of Motor Vehicles, requesting a trace on the motorhome Dr. Lecter said Raspale had bought in California, the one Raspale used in his romance with Klaus. Crawford asked the DMV to check for traffic tickets issued to any driver other than Benjamin Raspale. Then he sat on the sofa with a clipboard and worked out a provocative personal ad to run in the major papers. Juno-esque creamy passion flower, 21, model, seeks man who appreciates quality and quantity. Hand and cosmetic model, you've seen me in the magazine ads, now I'd like to see you. Send pics first letter. Crawford considered for a moment, scratched out Juno-esque and substituted full-figured. His head dipped, and he dozed. The green screen of the computer terminal made tiny squares in the lenses of his glasses. Movement on the screen now, the lines crawling upward, moving on Crawford's lenses. In his sleep he shook his head as though the image tickled him. The message was, Memphis POX recovered two items in search of Lecter's cell. One, improvised handcuff key made from ballpoint tube. Incisions by abrasion. Baltimore requested to check hospital cell for traces of manufacture. Off Copley, SAC, Memphis. 2. Sheet of notepaper left floating in toilet by fugitive. Original en route to WX document section lab. Graphic of writing follows. Graphic split to Langley. Attention Benson. Cryptography. When the graphic appeared, rising like something peeping over the bottom edge of the screen, it was this. C-33, H-36, I-L-T-06-N-4. The soft double beep of the computer terminal did not wake Crawford, but 3 minutes later the telephone did. It was Jerry Burrows at the National Crime Information Center hotline. See your screen, Jack?
Just a second, Crawford said.
Yeah, okay.
The lab's got it already, Jack. The drawing Lecter left in the John, the numbers between the letters in Chilton's name, it's biochemistry, C33, H36, N406. It's the formula for a pigment in human bile called bilirubin. Lab advises it's a chief coloring agent in shit.
Balls.
You were right about Lecter, Jack. He was just jerking them around. Too bad for Senator Martin. Lab says bilirubin's just about exactly the color of Chilton's hair. Asylum humor, they call it. Did you see Chilton on the 6 o'clock news?
No.
Marilyn Sutter saw it upstairs. Chilton was blowing off about the search for bilirubin. Then he went to dinner with a television reporter. That's where he was when Lecter took a walk. What a pluperfect asshole.
Lecter told Starling to bear in mind that Chilton didn't have a medical degree, Crawford said.
Yeah, I saw it in the summary. I think Chilton tried to fuck Starling's what I think, and she sawed him off at the knees. He may be dumb, but he ain't blind. How's the kid?
Okay, I think. Worn down.
Think Lecter was jerking her off, too?
Maybe.
We'll stay with it, though. I don't know what the clinics are doing. I keep thinking I should have gone after the records in court. I hate to have to depend on them. Mid-morning, if we haven't heard anything, we'll go the court route. Say, Jack, you got some people outside that know what Lecter looks like, right?
Sure.
Don't you know he's laughing somewhere?
Maybe not for long, Crawford said.
Chapter 43. Dr. Hannibal Lecter stood at the registration desk of the elegant Marcus Hotel in St. Louis. He wore a brown hat and a raincoat buttoned to the neck. A neat surgical bandage covered his nose and cheeks. He signed the register Lloyd Wyman, a signature he had practiced in Wyman's car.
"How will you be paying, Mr. Wyman?" the clerk said.
"American Express." Dr. Lecter handed the man Lloyd Wyman's credit card. Soft piano music came from the lounge. At the bar, Dr. Lecter could see two people with bandages across their noses. A middle-aged couple crossed to the elevators humming a Cole Porter tune.
The woman wore a gauze patch over her eye. The clerk finished making the credit card impression.
"You do know, Mr. Wyman, you're entitled to use the hospital garage."
"Yes, thank you," Dr. Lecter said. He had already parked Wyman's car in the garage, with Wyman in the trunk. The bellman who carried Wyman's bags to the small suite got one of Wyman's $5 bills in compensation. Dr. Lecter ordered a drink and a sandwich and relaxed with a long shower. The suite seemed enormous to Dr. Lecter after his long confinement. He enjoyed going to and fro in his suite and walking up and down in it. From his windows he could see across the street the Myron and Sadie Fleischer Pavilion of the St. Louis City Hospital, housing one of the world's foremost centers for craniofacial surgery. Dr. Lecter's visage was too well known for him to be able to take advantage of the plastic surgeons here, but it was one place in the world where he could walk around with a bandage on his face without exciting interest. He had stayed here once before, years ago, when he was doing psychiatric research in the superb Robert J. Brockman Memorial Library. Heady to have a window, several windows. He stood at his windows in the dark, watching the car lights move across the MacArthur Bridge and savoring his drink. He was pleasantly fatigued by the five-hour drive from Memphis. The only real rush of the evening had been in the underground garage at Memphis International Airport, cleaning up with cotton pads and alcohol and distilled water in the back of the parked ambulance was not at all convenient. Once he was in the attendant's whites, it was just a matter of catching a single traveler in a deserted aisle of long-term parking in the great garage. The man obligingly leaned into the trunk of his car for his sample case and never saw Dr. Lecter come up behind him. Dr. Lecter wondered if the police believed he was fool enough to fly from the airport. The only problem on the drive to St. Louis was finding the lights, the dimmers, and the wipers in the foreign car, as Dr. Lecter was unfamiliar with stock controls beside the steering wheel. Tomorrow he would shop for things he needed, hair bleach, barbering supplies, a sun lamp, and there were other prescription items that he would obtain to make some immediate changes in his appearance. When it was convenient, he would move on. There was no reason to hurry. Chapter 44. Ardelia Mapp was in her usual position, propped up in bed with a book. She was listening to All News Radio. She turned it off when Clarice Starling trudged in. Looking into Starling's drawn face, blessedly she didn't ask anything except, "Want some tea?" When she was studying, Mapp drank a beverage she brewed of mixed loose leaves her grandmother sent her, which she called Smart People's Tea. Of the two brightest people Starling knew, one was also the steadiest person she knew, and the other was the most frightening. Starling hoped that gave her some balance in her acquaintance. "You were lucky to miss today," Mapp said. "That damn Kim Won ran us right into the ground. I'm not lying. I believe they must have more gravity in Korea than we do. Then they come over here and get light, see, get jobs teaching P.E. because there's not any work for them. John Brigham came by." "When?" "Tonight, a little while ago. Wanted to know if you were back yet. He had his hair slicked down, shifted around like a freshman in the lobby. We had a little talk. He said if you're behind and we need to jam instead of shoot during the range period next couple of days, he'll open up the range this weekend and let us make it up. I said I'd let him know. He's a nice man."
"Yeah, he is."
"Did you know he wants you to shoot against the DEA and Customs in the inter-service match?"
"Nope."
"Not the women's, the open. Next question. Do you know the Fourth Amendment stuff for Friday?"
"A lot of it I do."
"Okay. What's Chimel versus California?"
"Searches in secondary schools."
"What about school searches?"
"I don't know."
"It's the immediate reach concept. Who was Sheckloth?"
"Hell, I don't know."
"Sheckloth versus Bustamante. Is it the reasonable expectation of privacy?"
"Boo to you. Expectation of privacy is the cat's principle. Sheckcloth is consent to search. I can see we've got a jam on the books, my girl. I've got the notes.
Not tonight.
No, but tomorrow you'll wake up with your mind fertile and ignorant, and then we'll begin to plant the harvest for Friday. Starling Brigham said he's not supposed to tell, so I promised. He said you'll beat the hearing. He thinks that signifying son-of-a-bitch Krendler won't remember you 2 days from now. Your grades are good. We'll knock this stuff out easy.
Mapp studied Starling's tired face.
You did the best anybody could for that poor soul, Starling. You stuck your neck out for her, and you got your butt kicked for her, and you moved things along. You deserve a chance yourself. Why don't you go ahead and crash? I'm fixing to shut this down myself.
Ardelia, thanks.
And after the lights were out,
Starling?
Yeah.
Who do you think's prettiest, Brigham or Hot Bobby Lawrence?
That's a hard one.
Brigham's got a tattoo on his shoulder. I could see it through his shirt. What does it say?
I wouldn't have any idea.
Will you let me know as soon as you find out?
Probably not.
I told you about Hot Bobby's python briefs.
You just saw him through the window when he was lifting weights.
Did Gracie tell you that? That girl's mouth is gonna...
Starling was asleep.
Chapter 45. Shortly before 3 a.m., Crawford, dozing beside his wife, came awake. There was a catch in Bella's breathing, and she had stirred on her bed. He sat up and took her hand.
Bella?
She took a deep breath and let it out. Her eyes were open for the first time in days. Crawford put his face close before hers, but he didn't think she could see him.
Bella, I love you, kid, he said, in case she could hear.
Fear brushed the walls of his chest, circling inside him like a bat in a house. Then he got hold of it. He wanted to get something for her, anything, but he did not want her to feel him let go of her hand. He put his ear to her chest. He heard a soft beat, a flutter, and then her heart stopped. There was nothing to hear. There was only a curious, cool rushing. He didn't know if the sound was in her chest or only in his ears.
God bless you and keep you with him.
And with your folks, Crawford said, words he wanted to be true. He gathered her to him on the bed, sitting against the headboard, held her to his chest while her brain died. His chin pushed back the scarf from the remnants of her hair. He did not cry. He had done all that. Crawford changed her into her favorite, her best bedgown, and sat for a while beside the high bed, holding her hand against his cheek. It was a square, clever hand, marked with a lifetime of gardening, marked by IV needles now. When she came in from the garden, her hand smelled like thyme. Think about it like egg white on your fingers, the girls at school had counseled Bella about sex. She and Crawford had joked about it in bed years ago, years later, last year. Don't think about that. Think about the good stuff, the pure stuff. That was the pure stuff. She wore a round hat and white gloves, and going up in the elevator the first time, he whistled a dramatic arrangement of Begin the Beguine. In the room, she teased him that he had the cluttered pockets of a boy. Crawford tried going into the next room. He still could turn when he wanted to and see her through the open door, composed in the warm light of the bedside lamp. He was waiting for her body to become a ceremonial object apart from him, separate from the person he had held upon the bed, and separate from the life's companion he held now in his mind, so he could call them to come for her. His empty hands hanging, palms forward at his sides, he stood at the window looking to the empty east. He did not look for dawn. East was only the way the window faced. Chapter 46.
Ready, precious?
Jane Gum was propped against the headboard of his bed and very comfortable, the little dog curled up warm on his tummy. Mr. Gum had just washed his hair, and he had a towel wrapped around his head. He rummaged in the sheets, found the remote control for his VCR, and pushed the play button. He had composed his program from two pieces of videotape copied onto one cassette. He watched it every day when he was making vital preparations, and he always watched it just before he harvested a hide. The first tape was from scratchy film of Movie Tone News, a black-and-white newsreel from 1948. It was the quarterfinals of the Miss Sacramento contest, a preliminary event on the long road to the Miss America pageant in Atlantic City. This was the swimsuit competition, and all the girls carried flowers as they came in a file to the stairs and mounted to the stage. Mr. Gum's poodle had been through this many times, and she squinted her eyes when she heard the music, knowing she'd be squeezed. The beauty contestants looked very World War II. They wore Rosemary Reed swimsuits, and some of the faces were lovely. Their legs were nicely shaped, too, some of them, but they lacked muscle tone and seemed to lap a little at the knee. Gum squeezed the poodle. "Precious, here she comes, here she comes, here she comes." And here she came, approaching the stairs in her white swimsuit, with a radiant smile for the young man who assisted at the stairs, then quick on her high heels away, the camera following the backs of her thighs. Mom. There was Mom. Mr. Gum didn't have to touch his remote control. He'd done it all when he dubbed this copy. In reverse, here she came backward, backward down the stairs, took back her smile from the young man, backed up the aisle, now forward again, and back, and forward, forward, and back. When she smiled at the young man, Gum smiled too. There was one more shot of her in a group, but it always blurred in freeze frame. Better just to run it at speed and get the glimpse. Mom was with the other girls, congratulating the winners. The next item, he'd taped off a cable television in a motel in Chicago. He'd had to rush out and buy a VCR and stay an extra night to get it. This was the loop film they run on CD cable channels late at night as background for the sex ads that crawl up the screen in print. The loops are made of junk film, fairly innocuous, naughty movies from the 40s and 50s, and there was nudist camp volleyball and the less explicit parts of 30s sex movies where the male actors wore false noses and still had their socks on. The sound was any music at all. Right now it was The Look of Love, totally out of sync with the sprightly action. There was nothing Mr. Gum could do about the ads crawling up the screen. He just had to put up with them. Here it is, an outdoor pool. In California, judging from the foliage. Good pool furniture, everything very 50s. Naked swimming, some graceful girls. A few of them might have appeared in a couple of B-pictures. Sprightly and bouncing, they climbed out of the pool and ran, much faster than the music, to the ladder of a water slide. Climbed up, down they came. Whee! Breasts lifting as they plunged down the slide, laughing, legs out straight, splash. Here came Mom. Here she came, climbing out of the pool behind the girl with the curly hair. Her face was partly covered by a crawl ad from Cinderella, a sex boutique. But here you saw her going away, and there she went up the ladder, all shiny and wet, wonderfully buxom and supple, with a small cesarean scar, and down the slide, whee! So beautiful. And even if he couldn't see her face, Mr. Gum knew in his heart it was Mom, filmed after the last time in his life that he ever got to really see her, except in his mind, of course. The scene switched to a filmed ad for a marital aid and abruptly ended. The poodle squinted her eyes 2 seconds before Mr. Gum hugged her tight. "Oh, precious! Come here to Mommy. Mommy's gonna be so beautiful." Much to do, much to do, much to do to get ready for tomorrow. He could never hear it from the kitchen, even at the top of its voice, thank goodness, but he could hear it on the stairs as he went down to the basement. He had hoped it would be quiet and asleep. The poodle, riding beneath his arm, growled back at the sounds from the pit. "You've been raised better than that," he said into the fur on the back of her head. The oubliette room is through a door to the left at the bottom of the stairs. He didn't spare it a glance, nor did he listen to the words from the pit. As far as he was concerned, they bore not the slightest resemblance to English. Mr. Gum turned right into the workroom, put the poodle down, and turned on the lights. A few moths fluttered and lit harmlessly on the wire mesh covering the ceiling lights. Mr. Gum was meticulous in the workroom. He always mixed his fresh solutions in stainless steel, never in aluminum. He had learned to do everything well ahead of time. As he worked, he admonished himself. You have to be orderly, you have to be precise, you have to be expeditious, because the problems are formidable. The human skin is heavy, 16 to 18% of body weight, and slippery. An entire hide is hard to handle and easy to drop when it's still wet. Time is important, too. Skin begins to shrink immediately after it has been harvested, most notably from young adults whose skin is tightest to begin with. Add to that the fact that the skin is not perfectly elastic, even in the young. If you stretch it, it never regains its original proportions. Stitch something perfectly smooth, then pull it too hard over a tailor's ham, and it bulges and puckers. Sitting at the machine and crying your eyes out won't remove one pucker. Then there are the cleavage lines, and you'd better know where they are. Skin doesn't stretch the same amount in all directions before the collagen bundles deform and the fibers tear. Pull the wrong way, and you get a stretch mark. Green material is simply impossible to work with. Much experimentation went into this, along with much heartbreak, before Mr. Gum got it right. In the end, he found the old ways were best. His procedures were these. First, he soaked his items in the aquariums, in vegetable extracts developed by the Native Americans, all natural substances that contain no mineral salts whatsoever. Then he used the method that produced the matchless, butter-soft buckskin of the New World, classic brain tanning. The Native Americans believed that each animal has just enough brains to tan its own hide. Mr. Gum knew that this was not true, and long ago had quit trying it, even with the largest-brained primate. He had a freezer full of beef brains now, so he never ran short. The problems of processing the material he could manage. Practice had made him near perfect. Difficult structural problems remained, but he was especially well qualified to solve them, too. The workroom opened into a basement corridor leading to a disused bath where Mr. Gum stored his hoisting tackle and his timepiece, and on to the studio and the vast black warren beyond. He opened his studio door to brilliant light. Floodlights and incandescent tubes, color-corrected to daylight, were fastened to ceiling beams. Mannequins posed on a raised floor of pickled oak. All were partly clad, some in leather, and some in muslin patterns for leather garments. 8 mannequins were doubled in the 2 mirrored walls. Good plate mirror, too, not tiles. A makeup table held cosmetics, several wig forms, and wigs. This was the brightest of studios, all white and blonde oak. The mannequins wore commercial work in progress, dramatic Armani knockoffs mostly, in fine black cabretta leather, all roll pleats and pointed shoulders and breastplates. The third wall was taken up by a large work table, 2 commercial sewing machines, 2 dressmaker's forms, and a tailor's form cast from the very torso of James Gum. Against the fourth wall, dominating this bright room, was a great black armoire in Chinese lacquer that rose almost to the 8-foot ceiling. It was old, and the designs on it had faded. A few gold scales remained where a dragon was, his white eyes still clear and staring, and here was the red tongue of another dragon whose body had faded away. The lacquer beneath them remained intact, though it was crackled. The armoire, immense and deep, had nothing to do with commercial work. It contained, on forms and hangers, the special things, and its doors were closed. The little dog lapped from her water bowl in the corner and lay down between the feet of a mannequin, her eyes on Mr. Gum. He had been working on a leather jacket. He needed to finish it. He'd meant to get everything out of the way, but he was in a creative fever now, and his own muslin fitting garment didn't satisfy him yet. Mr. Gum had progressed in tailoring far beyond what the California Department of Corrections had taught him in his youth. But this was a true challenge. Even working delicate cabretta leather does not prepare you for really fine work. Here he had two muslin fitting garments, like white waistcoats, one his exact size and one he had made from measurements he took while Catherine Baker Martin was still unconscious. When he put the smaller one on his tailor's form, the problems were apparent. She was a big girl and wonderfully proportioned, but she wasn't as big as Mr. Gum, and not nearly so broad across the back. His ideal was a seamless garment. This was not possible. He was determined, though, that the bodice front be absolutely seamless and without blemish. This meant all figure corrections had to be made on the back. Very difficult. He'd already discarded one fitting muslin and started over. With judicious stretching, he could get by with two underarm darts, not French darts, but vertical inset darts, apexes down. Two waist darts also, in the back, just inside his kidneys. He was used to working with only a tiny seam allowance. His considerations went beyond the visual aspects to the tactile. It was not inconceivable that an attractive person might be hugged. Mr. Gum sprinkled talc lightly on his hands and embraced the tailor's form of his body in a natural, comfortable hug.
"Give me a kiss," he said playfully to the empty air where the head should be. "Not you, silly," he told the little dog when she raised her ears.
Gum caressed the back of the form at the natural reach of his arms. Then he walked behind it to consider the powder marks. Nobody wanted to feel a seam. In an embrace, though, the hands lap over the center of the back. Also, he reasoned, we are accustomed to the center line of a spine. It is not as jarring as an asymmetry in our bodies. Shoulder seams were definitely out then. A center dart at the top was the answer, apex a little above the center of the shoulder blades. He could use the same seam to anchor the stout yoke built into the lining to provide support. Lycra panels beneath plackets on both sides. He must remember to get the lycra. And a Velcro closure beneath the placket on the right. He thought about those marvelous Charles James gowns where the seams were staggered to lie perfectly flat. The dart in back would be covered by his hair, or rather the hair he would have soon. Mr. Gum slipped the muslin off the dressmaker's form and started to work. The sewing machine was old and finely made, an ornate foot-treadle machine that had been converted to electricity perhaps 40 years ago. On the arm of the machine was painted in gold-leaf scroll, "I never tire, I serve." The foot-treadle remained operative, and Gum started the machine with it for each series of stitches. For fine stitching he preferred to work barefoot, rocking the treadle delicately with his meaty foot, gripping the front edge of it with his painted toes to prevent overruns. For a while there were only the sounds of the machine, and the little dog snoring, and the hiss of the steam pipes in the warm basement. When he had finished inserting the darts and the muslin pattern garment, he tried it on in front of the mirrors. The little dog watched from the corner, her head cocked. He needed to ease it a little under the armholes. There were a few remaining problems with facings and interfacings. Otherwise, it was so nice. It was supple, pliant, bouncy. He could see himself just running up the ladder of a water slide as fast as you please. Mr. Gum played with the lights and his wigs for some dramatic effects.
and he tried a wonderful choker necklace of shells over the collar line. It would be stunning when he wore a décolleté gown or hostess pajamas over his new thorax. It was so tempting to just go on with it now, to really get busy. But his eyes were tired. He wanted his hands to be absolutely steady, too, and he just wasn't up for the noise. Patiently he picked out the stitches and laid out the pieces. A perfect pattern to cut by. "Tomorrow, precious," he told the little dog as he set the beef brains out to thaw. "We'll do it first thing tomorrow. Mommy's gonna be so beautiful." Chapter 47 Starling slept hard for 5 hours and woke in the pit of the night, driven awake by fear of the dream. She bit the corner of the sheet and pressed her palms over her ears, waiting to find out if she was truly awake and away from it. Silence, and no lamb screaming. When she knew she was awake, her heart slowed, but her feet would not stay still beneath the covers. In a moment her mind would race, she knew it. It was a relief when a flush of hot anger rather than fear shot through her. "Nuts," she said, and put a foot out in the air. In all the long day, when she had been disrupted by Chilton, insulted by Senator Martin, abandoned and rebuked by Crendler, taunted by Dr. Lecter, and sickened by his bloody escape, and put off the job by Jack Crawford, there was one thing that stung the worst, being called a thief. Senator Martin was a mother under extreme duress, and she was sick of policemen pawing her daughter's things. She hadn't meant it. Still, the accusation stuck in Starling like a hot needle. As a small child, Starling had been taught that thieving is the cheapest, most despicable act short of rape and murder for money. Some kinds of manslaughter were preferable to theft. As a child in institutions where there were few prizes and many hungers, she had learned to hate a thief. Lying in the dark, she faced another reason Senator Martin's implication bothered her so. Starling knew what the malicious Dr. Lecter would say, and it was true. She was afraid there was something tacky that Senator Martin saw in her, something cheap, something thief-like that Senator Martin reacted to. That Vanderbilt bitch. Dr. Lecter would relish pointing out that class resentment, the buried anger that comes with mother's milk, was a factor too. Starling gave away nothing to any Martin in education, intelligence, drive, and certainly physical appearance, but still it was there, and she knew it. Starling was an isolated member of a fierce tribe with no formal genealogy but the honors list and the penal register. Dispossessed in Scotland, starved out of Ireland, a lot of them were inclined to the dangerous trades. Many generic starlings had been used up this way, had thumped on the bottom of narrow holes, or slid off planks with a shot at their feet, or were commended to glory with a cracked taps in the cold when everyone wanted to go home. A few may have been recalled tearily by the officers on regimental mess nights, the way a man in drink remembers a good bird dog. Faded names in a Bible. None of them had been very smart, as far as Starling could tell, except for a great aunt who wrote wonderfully in her diary until she got brain fever. They didn't steal, though. School was the thing in America, don't you know, and the Starlings caught on to that. One of Starling's uncles had his junior college degree cut on his tombstone. Starling had lived by schools, her weapon, the competitive exam, for all the years when there was no place else for her to go. She knew she could pull out of this. She could be what she had always been, ever since she'd learned how it works. She could be near the top of her class, approved, included, chosen, and not sent away. It was a matter of working hard and being careful. Her grades would be good. The Korean couldn't kill her in P.E. Her name would be engraved on the big plaque in the lobby, the possible board for extraordinary performance on the range. In 4 weeks,
she would be a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Would she have to watch out for that fucking Krendler for the rest of her life? In the presence of the senator, he had wanted to wash his hands of her. Every time Starling thought about it, it stung. He wasn't positive that he would find evidence in the envelope. That was shocking. Picturing Krendler now in her mind, she saw him wearing navy oxfords on his feet like the mayor, her father's boss, coming to collect the watchman's clock. Worse, Jack Crawford in her mind seemed diminished. The man was under more strain than anyone should have to bear. He had sent her in to check out Raspail's car with no support or evidence of authority. Okay, she had asked to go under those terms. The trouble was a fluke. But Crawford had to know there'd be trouble when Senator Martin saw her in Memphis. There would have been trouble even if she hadn't found the fuck pictures. Catherine Baker Martin lay in this same darkness that held her now. Starling had forgotten it for a moment while she thought about her own best interests. Pictures of the past few days punished Starling for the lapse, flashed on her in sudden color, too much color, shocking color, the color that leaps out of black when lightning strikes at night. It was Kimberly that haunted her now. Fat, dead Kimberly, who had her ears pierced, trying to look pretty, and saved to have her legs waxed. Kimberly, with her hair gone. Kimberly, her sister. Starling did not think Catherine Baker Martin would have much time for Kimberly. Now they were sisters under the skin, Kimberly lying in a funeral home full of state trooper buckaroos. Starling couldn't look at it anymore. She tried to turn her face away as a swimmer turns to breathe. All of Buffalo Bill's victims were women. His obsession was women. He lived to hunt women. Not one woman was hunting him full time. Not one woman investigator had looked at every one of his crimes. Starling wondered if Crawford would have the nerve to use her as a technician when he had to go look at Catherine Martin. Bill would do her tomorrow, Crawford predicted. Do her. Do her. Do her. Fuck this, Starling said aloud and put her feet on the floor. You're over there corrupting a moron, aren't you, Starling? Ardelia Mapp said. Sneaked him in here while I was asleep, and now you're giving him instructions. Don't think I don't hear you. Sorry, Ardelia, I didn't. You've got to be a lot more specific with him than that, Starling. You can't just say what you said. Corrupting morons is just like journalism. You got to tell them what, when, where, and how. I think why gets self-explanatory as you go along. Have you got any laundry? I thought you said, did I have any laundry? Yep, I think I'll run a load. What you got? Just those sweats on the back of the door. Okay, shut your eyes. I'm going to turn on the light for just a second. It was not the Fourth Amendment notes for her upcoming exam that she piled on top of the clothes basket and lugged down the hall to the laundry room. She took the Buffalo Bill file, a 4-inch thick pile of hell and pain in a buff cover printed with ink the color of blood. With it was a hotline printout of her report on the Death's Head Moth. She'd have to give the file back tomorrow, and if she wanted this copy to be complete, sooner or later she had to insert her report. In the warm laundry room, in the washing machine's comforting chug, she took off the rubber bands that held the file together. She laid out the papers on the clothes-folding shelf and tried to do the insert without seeing any of the pictures, without thinking of what pictures might be added soon. The map was on top, that was fine. But there was handwriting on the map. Dr. Lecter's elegant script ran across the Great Lakes, and it said, Clarice, does this random scattering of sights seem overdone to you? Doesn't it seem desperately random? Random past all possible convenience? Does it suggest to you the elaborations of a bad liar? Ta. Hannibal Lecter. P.S. Don't bother to flip through. There isn't anything else. It took 20 minutes of page-turning to be sure there wasn't anything else. Starling called the hotline from the payphone in the hall and read the message to Burroughs. She wondered when Burroughs slept. I have to tell you, Starling, the market in Lecter information is way down, Burroughs said.
Did Jack call you about Billy Rubin?
No. She leaned against the wall with her eyes closed while he described Dr. Lecter's joke.
I don't know, he said at last. Jack says they'll go on with the sex change clinics, but how hard? If you look at the information in the computer, the way the field entries are styled, you can see that all the Lecter information, yours and the stuff from Memphis, has special prefixes. All the Baltimore stuff or all the Memphis stuff or both can be knocked out of consideration with one button. I think Justice wants to push the button on all of it. I got a memo here suggesting the bug in Klaus's throat was, let's see, flotsam.
You'll punch this up for Mr. Crawford, though, Starling said.
Sure, I'll put it on his screen, but we're not calling him right now. You shouldn't either. Bella died a little while ago.
Oh, Starling said.
Listen, on the bright side, our guys in Baltimore took a look at Lecter's cell in the asylum. That orderly Barney helped out. They got brass grindings off a bolt head in Lecter's cot where he made his handcuff key. Hang in there, kid. You're going to come out smelling like a rose.
Thank you, Mr. Burroughs. Good night.
Smelling like a rose, putting Vic's vapor rub under her nostrils. Daylight coming on the last day of Catherine Martin's life.
What could Dr. Lecter mean?
There was no knowing what Dr. Lecter knew. When she first gave him the file, she expected him to enjoy the pictures and use the file as a prop while he told her what he already knew about Buffalo Bill. Maybe he was always lying to her, just as he lied to Senator Martin. Maybe he didn't know or understand anything about Buffalo Bill. He sees very clearly. He damn sure sees through me. It's hard to accept that someone can understand you without wishing you well. At Starling's age, it hadn't happened to her much. Desperately random, Dr. Lecter said. Starling and Crawford and everyone else had stared at the map with its dots marking the abductions and body dumps. It had looked to Starling like a black constellation with a date beside each star, and she knew behavioral science had once tried imposing zodiac signs on the map without result. If Dr. Lecter was reading for recreation, why would he fool with the map? She could see him flipping through the report, making fun of the prose style of some of the contributors. There was no pattern in the abductions and body dumps, no relationships of convenience, no coordination in time with any known business conventions, any spate of burglaries or clothesline thefts or other fetish-oriented crimes. Back in the laundry room with the dryer spinning, Starling walked her fingers over the map. Here an abduction, there the dump. Here the second abduction, there the dump. Here the third and...
But are these dates backward, or...
No, the second body was discovered first. That fact was recorded, unremarked, in smudged ink beside the location on the map. The body of the second woman abducted was found first, floating in the Wabash River in downtown Lafayette, Indiana, just below Interstate 65. The first young woman reported missing was taken from Belvedere, Ohio, near Columbus, and found much later in the Blackwater River in Missouri, outside of Lone Jack. The body was weighted. No others were weighted. The body of the first victim was sunk in water in a remote area. The second was dumped in a river upstream from a city where quick discovery was certain. Why? The one he started with was well hidden, the second one not. Why? What does desperately random mean? The first. First. What did Dr. Lecter say about first? What did anything mean that Dr. Lecter said? Starling looked at the note she had scribbled on the airplane from Memphis. Dr. Lecter said there was enough in the file to locate the killer. Simplicity, he said. What about first? Where was first? Here, first principles were important. First principles sounded like pretentious bullshit when he said it. What does he do, Clarice? What is the first and principal thing he does? What need does he serve by killing? He covets.
How do we begin to covet? We begin by coveting what we see every day. It was easier to think about Dr. Lecter's statements when she wasn't feeling his eyes on her skin. It was easier here in the safe heart of Quantico. If we begin to covet by coveting what we see every day, did Buffalo Bill surprise himself when he killed the first one? Did he do someone close around him? Is that why he hid the first body well and the second one poorly? Did he abduct the second one far from home and dump her where she'd be found quickly because he wanted to establish early the belief that the abduction sites were random? When Starling thought of the victims, Kimberly Emberg came first to mind because she had seen Kimberly dead and, in a sense, had taken Kimberly's part. Here was the first one. Frederica Bimmel, 22, Belvedere, Ohio. There were two photos. In her yearbook picture, she looked large and plain, with good thick hair and a good complexion. In the second photo, taken at the Kansas City morgue, she looked like nothing human. Starling called Burroughs again. He was sounding a little hoarse by now, but he listened. "So, what are you saying, Starling?" "Maybe he lives in Belvedere, Ohio, where the first victim lived. Maybe he saw her every day, and he killed her sort of spontaneously. Maybe he just meant to give her a 7-Up and talk about the choir. So he did a good job of hiding the body, and then he grabbed another one far from home. He didn't hide that one very well, so it would be found first, and the attention would be directed away from him. You know how much attention a missing person report gets. It gets zip until the body's found."
"Starling, the return's better where the trail is fresh. People remember better. Witnesses,
that's what I'm saying. He knows that.
Or, for instance, you won't be able to sneeze today without spraying a cop in that last one's hometown, Kimberly Emberg from Detroit. A lot of interest in Kimberly Emberg all of a sudden since little Martin disappeared. All of a sudden they're working the hell out of it. You never heard me say that.
Will you put it up for Mr. Crawford about the first town?"
"Sure. Hell, I'll put it on the hotline for everybody. I'm not saying it's bad thinking, Starling, but the town was picked over pretty good as soon as the woman, what's her name, Bimmel, is it, as soon as Bimmel was identified. The Columbus office worked Belvedere, and so did a lot of locals. You got it all there. You're not going to raise much interest in Belvedere or any other theory of Dr. Lecter's this morning. All heat, Starling. We're sending a gift to UNICEF for Bella. You want in, I'll put your name on the card."
"Sure, thanks, Mr. Burroughs." Starling got the clothes out of the dryer. The warm laundry felt good and smelled good. She hugged the warm laundry close to her chest. Her mother with an armload of sheets. Today is the last day of Catherine's life. The black and white crow stole from the cart. She couldn't be outside to shoo it and in the room, too. Today is the last day of Catherine's life. Her father used an arm signal instead of the blinkers when he turned his pickup into the driveway. Playing in the yard, she thought, with his big arm, he showed the pickup where to turn, grandly directed it to turn. When Starling decided what she would do, a few tears came. She put her face in the warm laundry. Chapter 48. Crawford came out of the funeral home and looked up and down the street for Jeff with the car. Instead, he saw Clarice Starling waiting under the awning, dressed in a dark suit, looking real in the light. "Send me," she said. Crawford had just picked out his wife's coffin, and he carried in a paper sack a pair of her shoes he had mistakenly brought. He collected himself. "Forgive me," Starling said. "I wouldn't come now if there were any other time. Send me." Crawford jammed his hands in his pockets, turned his neck in his collar until it popped. His eyes were bright, maybe dangerous. "Send you where?" "You sent me to get a feel for Catherine Martin. Let me go to the others. All we've got left is to find out how he hunts, how he finds them, how he picks them. I'm as good as anybody you've got at the cop stuff, better at some things. The victims are all women, and there aren't any women working this. I can walk in a woman's room and know 3 times as much about her as a man would know, and you know that's a fact. Send me." "You ready to accept a recycle?"
"Yes."
6 months of your life, probably. She didn't say anything. Crawford stubbed at the grass with his toe. He looked up at her, at the prairie distance in her eyes. She had backbone like Bella. Who would you start with?
The first one, Frederica Bimmel, Belvedere, Ohio.
Not Kimberly Emberg, the one you saw.
He didn't start with her.
Mention Lecter? No, he'd see it on the hotline. Emberg would be the emotional choice, wouldn't she, starling? Travels by reimbursement. Got any money? The banks wouldn't open for an hour.
I've got some left on my visa.
Crawford dug in his pockets. He gave her $300 cash and a personal check. Go, starling. Just to the first one. Post the hotline. Call me. She raised her hand to him. She didn't touch his face or his hand. There didn't seem to be any place to touch. And she turned and ran for the Pinto. Crawford patted his pockets as she drove away. He had given her the last cent he had with him.
Baby needs a new pair of shoes, he said. My baby doesn't need any shoes.
He was crying in the middle of the sidewalk, sheets of tears on his face, a section chief of the FBI, silly now. Jeff from the car saw his cheeks shine and backed into an alley where Crawford couldn't see him. Jeff got out of the car. He lit a cigarette and smoked furiously. As his gift to Crawford, he would dawdle until Crawford was dried off and pissed off and justified in chewing him out. Chapter 49. On the morning of the fourth day, Mr. Gum was ready to harvest the hide. He came in from shopping with the last things he needed, and it was hard to keep from running down the basement stairs. In the studio, he unpacked his shopping bags, new bias seam binding, panels of stretchy lycra to go under the plackets, a box of kosher salt. He had forgotten nothing. In the workroom, he laid out his knives on a clean towel beside the long sinks. The knives were four, a sway-backed skinning knife, a delicate drop-point caper that perfectly followed the curve of the index finger in close places, a scalpel for the closest work, and a World War I-era bayonet. The rolled edge of the bayonet is the finest tool for fleshing a hide without tearing it. In addition, he had a Stryker autopsy saw, which he hardly ever used and regretted buying. Now he greased the head of a wig stand, packed coarse salt over the grease, and set the stand in a shallow drip pan. Playfully he tweaked the nose on the face of the wig stand and blew it a kiss. It was hard to behave in a responsible manner. He wanted to fly about the room like Danny Kaye. He laughed and blew a moth away from his face with a gentle puff of air. Time to start the aquarium pumps in his fresh tanks of solution. Oh, was there a nice chrysalis buried in the humus in the cage? He poked with his finger. Yes, there was. The pistol now. The problem of killing this one had perplexed Mr. Gum for days. Hanging her was out because he didn't want the pectoral modeling, and besides, he couldn't risk the knot tearing her behind the ear. Mr. Gum had learned from each of his previous efforts, sometimes painfully. He was determined to avoid some of the nightmares he'd gone through before. One cardinal principle. No matter how weak from hunger or faint with fright, they always fought you when they saw the apparatus. He had in the past hunted young women through the blacked-out basement, using his infrared goggles and light, and it was wonderful to do, watching them feel their way around, seeing them try to scrunch into corners. He liked to hunt them with the pistol. He liked to use the pistol. Always they became disoriented, lost their balance, ran into things. He could stand in absolute darkness with his goggles on, wait until they took their hands down from their faces, and shoot them right in the head. Or in the legs first, below the knee, so they could still crawl. That was childish, and a waste. They were useless afterward, and he had quit doing it altogether. In his current project, he had offered showers upstairs to the first three, before he booted them down the staircase with a noose around their necks. No problem. But the fourth had been a disaster.
He'd had to use the pistol in the bathroom, and it had taken an hour to clean up. He thought about the girl, wet, goosebumps on her, and how she shivered when he cocked the pistol. He liked to cock it. Snick, snick, one big bang, and no more racket. He liked his pistol, and well he should, because it was a very handsome piece, a stainless steel Colt Python with a 6-inch barrel. All Python actions are tuned at the Colt Custom Shop, and this one was a pleasure to feel. He cocked it now and squeezed it off, catching the hammer with his thumb. He loaded the Python and put it on the workroom counter. Mr. Gum wanted very much to offer this one a shampoo, because he wanted to watch it comb out the hair. He could learn much for his own grooming about how the hair lay on the head. But this one was tall and probably strong. This one was too rare to risk having to waste the whole thing with gunshot wounds. No, he'd get his hoisting tackle from the bathroom, offer her a bath, and when she had put herself securely in the hoisting sling, he'd bring her halfway up the shaft of the oubliette and shoot her several times low in the spine. When she lost consciousness, he could do the rest with chloroform. That's it. He'd go upstairs now and get out of his clothes. He'd wake up Precious and watch his video with her and then go to work, naked in the warm basement. Naked as the day he was born. He felt almost giddy going up the stairs. Quickly out of his clothes and into his robe, he plugged in his video cassette. Precious! Come on, Precious! Busy, busy day! Come on, sweetheart! He'd have to shut her up here in the upstairs bedroom while he got through with the noisy part in the basement. She hated the noise and got terribly upset. To keep her occupied, he'd gotten her a whole box of Chewies while he was out shopping. Precious! When she didn't come, he called in the hall. Precious! And then in the kitchen and in the basement. Precious! When he called at the door of the oubliette room, he got an answer. She's down here, you son of a bitch, Catherine Martin said. Mr. Gum sickened all over in a plunge of fear for Precious. Then rage tightened him again, and fists against the sides of his head, he pressed his forehead into the door frame and tried to get hold of himself. One sound between a retch and a groan escaped him, and the little dog answered with a yip. He went to the workroom and got his pistol. The string to the sanitation bucket was broken. He still wasn't sure how she'd done it. Last time the string was broken, he'd assumed she'd broken it in an absurd attempt to climb. They had tried to climb it before. They had done every fool thing imaginable. He leaned over the opening, his voice carefully controlled. Precious, are you all right? Answer me. Catherine pinched the dog's plump behind. It yipped and paid her back with a nip on the arm. How's that? Catherine said. It seemed very unnatural to Mr. Gum to speak to Catherine in this way, but he overcame his distaste. I'll lower a basket. You'll put her in it. You'll lower a telephone or I'll have to break her neck. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to hurt this little dog. Just give me the telephone. Mr. Gum brought the pistol up. Catherine saw the muzzle extending past the light. She crouched, holding the dog above her, weaving it between her and the gun. She heard him cock the pistol. You shoot, motherfucker! You better kill me quick or I'll break her fucking neck, I swear to God! She put the dog under her arm, put her hand around its muzzle, raised its head. Back off, you son of a bitch! The little dog whined. The gun withdrew. Catherine brushed the hair back from her wet forehead with her free hand. I didn't mean to insult you, she said. Just lower me a phone. I want a live phone. You can go away. I don't care about you. I never saw you. I'll take good care of Precious. No. I'll see she has everything. Think about her welfare, not just yourself. You shoot in here, she'll be deaf, whatever happens. All I want's a live telephone. Get a long extension, get 5 or 6, and clip 'em together. They come with the connections on the ends, and lower it down here. I'd air freight you the dog anywhere. My family has dogs. My mother loves dogs. You can run. I don't care what you do. You won't get any more water. You've had your last water. She won't get any either, and I won't give her any for my water bottle. I'm sorry to tell you, I think her leg's broken.
This was a lie. The little dog, along with the baited bucket, had fallen onto Catherine, and it was Catherine